Please, Jess, Nick says in a reasonable tone. Just hear me out. I'll come down there, and we can chat.
For a moment, I think, just because they're a family, it doesn't mean they're all responsible for what's happened here. I remember how Nick briefly referred to his father as a bit of a cunt. Clearly, they don't all see eye to eye. Maybe I've jumped to conclusions. Maybe she really did fall. An old woman, frail, slipping on the stairs late at night. No one to hear her because it's late. And maybe the front gate is locked because it's late, too.
No. I'm not going to take my chances.
I turn to look back at the concierge, slumped on the floor and grimacing in pain. And as I do, I see the door to the first floor apartment opening. I watch as Antoine steps out onto the landing to stand next to his brother. The two of them so much more alike than I had realized. He smiles down at me, a horrible grin.
Hello, little girl, he says.
Where to run? The front gate is locked. I refuse to be the girl in the horror film who flees into the basement. Both brothers are advancing towards me down the stairs now. I don't have any time to think. Instinctively, I step into the lift. I press the button for the third floor. The lift clanks upwards, the mechanism grinding. I can hear Nick running up the stairs below. Through the metal grille, I can see the top of his head. He's chasing me. The gloves are off now. Finally, I reach the third floor. The lift clanks into place, agonizingly slowly. I open the metal gate and dash across the landing, shove the keys into the door to Ben's apartment and fling it open, slam it shut behind me, lock the door. My chest heaving. I try to think, panic making me stupid, just when I need my thoughts to be as clear as possible. The back staircase, I could try and use that, but the sofa's in the way. I run to it, start trying to tug it away from the door. Then I hear the unmistakable sound of a key beginning to turn in the lock. I back away. He has a key. Of course he has a key. Could I pull something in front of the door? No. There's no time. Nick starts advancing towards me across the room. The cat, seeing him, streaks past and jumps up onto the kitchen counter to his right, mewing at him, perhaps hoping to be fed. Traitor.
Come on, Jess. Nick says, coaxingly, still that chillingly reasonable tone. Just stay where you are.
This new menace in Nick is so much more frightening than if he hadn't worn that nice guy mask before. I mean, his brother's violence has always seemed to simmer just beneath the surface. But Nick, this new Nick, he's an unknown quantity.
So what? I ask him. So you can do the same thing to me that you've done to Ben?
I didn't do anything.
There's a strange emphasis on the way he says this. A stress on the I.
I didn't.
Are you saying someone else did? One of the others?
He doesn't answer. Keep him talking. I tell myself, play for time.
I thought you wanted to help me, Nick, I say.
He looks pained now.
I did want to, Jess. And it's all my fault. I set this whole thing in motion. I invited him here. I should have known. He went digging into stuff he shouldn't have. Fuck.
He rubs at his face with his hands, and when he takes them away, I see that his eyes are rimmed with red.
It's my fault. And I'm sorry.
I feel a coldness creeping through me. What have you done to Ben, Nick?
I meant it to sound tough, authoritative, but my voice comes out with a tremor.
I haven't. I didn't. I haven't done anything.
Again, that emphasis.
I didn't. I haven't.
The only way out is past Nick, through that front door. Just by the door is the kitchen area. The utensil pots right there. Inside it is that razor-sharp Japanese knife. If I can just keep him talking, somehow grab the knife.
Come on, Jess.
He takes another step towards me. And suddenly there's a streak of movement, a flash of black and white. The cat has leapt from the kitchen counter onto Nick's shoulders, the same way it greeted me the very first time I entered this apartment. Nick swears, puts his hands up to tear the animal away. I sprint forwards, yank the knife out of the pot. Then I lunge past him for the door, wrench it open and slam it behind me.
Hello, little girl.
I turn. Fuck. Antoine stands there. He must have been waiting in the shadows. I lunge the knife towards him, slashing so violently at the air with the blade that he staggers backwards and falls down the flight of stairs, collapsing in a heap on the next landing. I peer at him through the gloom, my chest burning. I think I hear a groan, but he's not moving. Nick will be out any moment. There's only one way to go. Up. I'm clearly outnumbered here. One of me, four of them. But perhaps there's somewhere I can hide, to try and buy some time.
Come on, Jess. Think. You've always been good at thinking yourself out of a tight spot.
Mimi, fourth floor. What's going on out there? Maman? After everything I have learned, the word still feels strange. Painful.
Shh,
she says, stroking my hair.
Shh, ma petite.
I'm crouched on the bed, trembling. She came down to check on me. I've allowed her to sit beside me, to put an arm around my shoulders. Look, she says. Just stay in here, yes? I'm going to go out there and see what's going on. I grab hold of her wrist. No, please don't leave me. I hate the neediness in my voice, my need for her, but I can't help it. Please, I say, Maman? Just for a couple of minutes, she says. I just have to make sure. No, please don't leave me here, Mimi, she says sharply. Let go of my arm. Please. But I keep hanging on to her. In spite of everything, I don't want her to leave me. Because then I'd be left alone with my thoughts, like a little girl afraid of the monsters under the bed.
Jess. I sprint up the stairs, taking them two at a time. Fear makes me run faster than I've ever done in my life. Finally, I'm on the top floor, opposite the door to the penthouse apartment, the wooden ladder up to the old maid's quarters in front of me. I begin to climb, ascending into the darkness. Maybe I can hide out here long enough to gather my thoughts, work out what the hell I'm going to do next. I'm already pulling the hoop earrings from my ears, bending them into the right shape, making my rake and my pick. I grab for the padlock, get to work. Normally I'm so quick at this, but my hands are shaking. I can feel that one of the pins inside the lock is seized, and I just can't get the pressure right to reset it. Finally, the lock pops open, and I wrench it off and push open the door. I close it again quickly behind me. The open padlock is the only thing to give me away. I'll just have to pray they won't immediately guess I've come in here. My eyes start to adjust in the gloom. I'm looking into a cramped attic space, long and thin. The ceiling slopes down sharply above me. I have to crouch so I don't knock my head on one of the big wooden beams. It's dark, but there's a dim glow which I realize is the full moon, filtering in through the small, smeared attic windows. It smells of old wood and trapped air up here, and something animal, sweat, or something worse, something decaying. Something that stops me from breathing in too deeply. The air feels thick, full of dust motes which float in front of me in the bars of moonlight. It feels as though I have just pushed open a door into another world, where time has been suspended for 100 years. I move forwards, looking around for somewhere to hide. Over in the dim far corner of the space, I see what looks like an old mattress. There appears to be something on top of it. I have that feeling again, like I did downstairs when I found the concierge. I don't want to step any closer. I don't want to look. But I do, because I have to know. Now I can see what it is. Who it is. I see the blood. I understand. He's been up here all along. And I forget that I'm meant to be hiding from them. I forget everything, apart from the horror of what I'm looking at. I scream and scream and scream.
Mimi, fourth floor. A scream tears through the apartment. He's dead! He's dead, you fucking killed him! I let go of my mother's arm. The storm in my head is growing louder, louder. It's a swarm of bees. Then like being crashed underwater by the waves. Now like standing in the middle of a hurricane. But it still isn't loud enough to shut out the thoughts that are beginning to seep in. The memories. I remember blood. So much blood. You know how when you're a kid you can't sleep because you're afraid of the monsters under the bed? What happens if you start to suspect that the monster might be you? Where do you hide then? It's like the memories have been kept behind a locked door in my mind. I have been able to see the door. I have known it's there. And I have known that there is something terrible behind it. Something I don't want to see. Ever. But now the door is opening, the memories flooding out. The iron stink of the blood. The wooden floor slippery with it. And in my hand, my canvas cutting knife. I remember them pushing me into the shower. Maman, someone else too, maybe. Washing me down. The blood running dilute and pink into the drain, swirling around my toes. I was shivering all over. I couldn't stop. But not because the shower was cold. It was hot, scalding. There was a deep coldness inside me. I remember Maman holding me like she did when I was a little girl, and even though I was so angry with her, so confused, All I wanted suddenly was to cling to her, to be that little girl again. Maman, I said, I'm frightened. What happened?
Shh. She stroked my hair. It's okay. She told me I'm not going to let anything happen. I'll protect you. Just let me take care of all of this. You aren't going to get into any trouble.
It was his fault. You did what had to be done, what I wasn't brave enough to do myself.
We had to get rid of him.
What do you mean? I searched her face, trying to understand. Maman, what do you mean? She looked closely at me then, stared hard into my eyes. Then she nodded, tightly.
You don't remember?
Yes. Yes, it's best like that. Later there was something crusted under my fingernails, a reddish-brown rust color. I scrubbed at it with a toothbrush in the bathroom until my nail bed started bleeding. I didn't care about the pain. I just wanted to be rid of whatever it was. But that was the only thing that seemed real. The rest of it was like a dream. And then she arrived here. And the next morning she came to the door. She knocked and knocked until I had to open it. Then she said those terrible words. My brother, Ben, he's... well, he's kind of disappeared. That was when I realized it could have been real after all. I think it might have been me. I think I might have killed him.
Sophie, penthouse.
He's dead! He's dead! You fucking killed him!
I have to go, Cherie, I tell Mimi. I have to go and deal with this. I step onto the landing, leaving her in the apartment. I look upwards. It has happened. The girl is in the Chambre de Bon. She's found him. I remember pushing open the door to his apartment that terrible night. My daughter covered in blood. She opened her mouth as though to speak or scream, but nothing came out. The concierge was there too, somehow. But then of course she was. She sees, knows everything, moving around this apartment building like a spectre. I stood looking at the scene before me in a state of utter shock. And a strange sense of practicality took over. We need to wash her, I said. Get rid of all this blood. The concierge nodded. She took Mimi by the shoulders and led her towards the shower. Mimi was muttering a stream of words now. About Ben, about betrayal, about the club. She knew. And for some reason, she had not come to me. When she was clean, the concierge took her away, back to her apartment. I could see my daughter was in a state of shock. I wanted to go with her, comfort her. But first I had to deal with the consequences of what she had done. The thing, in all honesty, that I had considered doing myself. I found and used every tea towel in the apartment. Every towel from the bathroom. All of them, soaked through crimson. I wrenched the curtains down from the windows and wrapped the body in them, tied it carefully with the curtain cords. I hid the weapon in the dumbwaiter, in its secret cavity inside the wall, and wound the handle so it traveled up to a space between the floors. The concierge brought bleach. I used it to clean up after I'd washed the blood away, breathing through my mouth so as not to smell it. I pressed the back of my hand to my mouth. I couldn't vomit. I had to stay in control. The bleach stained the floor, leached the varnish out of the wood. It left a huge mark, even larger than the pooling blood. But it was the best I could do, better than the alternative. And then, I don't know how much later, the door opened. It wasn't even locked. I had forgotten that in the face of the task ahead of me. They stood there. The two Meunier boys, my stepsons,
Nicolas and Antoine,
staring at me in horror. The bleach stain in front of me, blood up to my elbows, Nick's face drained of all color. There's been a terrible accident, I said. Jesus Christ, Nicolas said, swallowing hard. Is this because... There was a long pause while I tried to think of what to say, I would not speak Mimi's name. I decided that Jacques could take the blame as a father should. This was, after all, really his mess. I settled on, your father found out what Ben had been working on. Oh, Jesus! Nick put his face in his hands, and then he howled like a small child, a sound of terrible pain. His eyes were wet, his mouth gaping. This is all my fault. I told Papa. I told him what Mimi had found, what Ben had been writing. I had no idea. If I'd known, oh, Jesus! For a moment, he seemed to sway where he stood. Then he rushed from the room. I heard him vomiting in the bathroom. Antoine stood there, arms folded. He looked equally sickened, but I could see he was determined to tough it out. Serves him right, the putain du bâtard, he said finally. I'd have done it myself. But he didn't sound convinced. A few minutes later, Nick returned, looking pale but determined. The three of us stood there, staring at one another. Never before had we been anything like a family. Now, we were oddly united. No words passed between us, just a silent nod of solidarity. Then, we got to work.
Jess. Even in my darkest moments over the last couple of days, even learning what Ben had got himself into, I haven't allowed myself to imagine it. Not finding my brother like this. How I found Mum. I sink to my knees. It doesn't look like my brother, the body on the mattress. It isn't just the pale, waxy colour of the skin, the sunken eye sockets. It's that I've never seen him so still. I can't think of my brother without thinking of his quick grin, his energy. I take in the dark, rusted crimson colour of his t-shirt. I can see that elsewhere the fabric is pale. It's a stain. It covers his entire front. He must have been up here all along. All this time. While I've been scurrying around following clues, tying myself in knots, thinking I was helping him somehow. And to think I'd seen that locked attic door on my first morning here. Crouched here beside him, I rock back and forth as the tears begin to fall. I'm so sorry, I say. I'm so bloody sorry. I reach down to take a hold of his hand. When was the last time we held hands? My brother and I. That day in the police station, maybe. After Mum. Before we went our separate ways. I squeeze his fingers tight. Then I almost drop his hand in shock. I could have sworn I felt his fingers twitch against mine. I know it's my imagination, of course. But for a moment, I really thought. I glance up. His eyes are open. They weren't open before, were they? I get to my feet, stand over him, heart thundering. Ben! I'm sure I just saw him blink. Ben! Another blink. I didn't imagine it. I can see his eyes attempting to focus on mine. And now he opens his mouth, but no sound comes out. Then,
Jess.
It's little more than an exhalation, but I definitely heard him say it. He closes his eyes again, as though he's very, very tired. Ben, I say. Come on, hey, sit up. It suddenly seems very important to get him upright. I put my arms under his armpits. He's almost a dead weight. But somehow I manage to haul him into a sitting position.
He half slumps forward, and his eyes are cloudy with confusion. But they are open.
Oh, Ben.
I take hold of his shoulders. I don't dare hug him in case he's too badly hurt. Tears are streaming down my face now. I let them fall.
Oh my God, Ben, you're alive. You're alive.
I hear a door slam behind me. It's the door to the attic. For a moment, I had genuinely forgotten about anything and anyone else. I turn around, slowly. Sophie Minier stands there. Behind her, Nick. And even though I'm reeling from everything that's just happened, I'm still able to make out that there's a big difference in their expressions. Sophie's face is an intense, terrifying mask. But Nick's, as he looks at Ben, shows surprise, horror, confusion. In fact, Nick looks, and this is the only way I can think to describe it, as though he has seen a ghost.
Nick, second floor. I feel dread creeping through me as I take in the scene in the attic. I ran up here when I heard the screaming after dragging Antoine semi-conscious to the sofa in my apartment. He's here. Ben is here. He doesn't look well, but he is sitting up. And he is alive. This can't be right. It doesn't make any sense. It's not possible. Ben is dead. He's been dead since Friday night. My one-time friend, my old university mate, the guy I fell for on that warm summer night in Amsterdam over a decade ago, and have been thinking about ever since. He died, and it was my fault, and in the days since, I have been trying to live with the guilt and the grief of it, walking around feeling only barely alive myself. I look to my stepmother, expecting to see my own shock reflected in her expression. It isn't there. This doesn't seem to have come as a surprise to her. She knows. It's the only explanation. Why else would she be so calm? Finally, I manage to speak. What is this? I ask, voice hoarse. What is this? What the fuck is happening? I point to Ben. This isn't possible. He's dead. You see, I know it for a fact. I had plenty of time to take it all in. The unspeakable horror of that lifeless shape in its makeshift shroud. The undeniable fact of it. Of the blood, too, spilled across the floorboards and soaked into the towels. Far more blood than anyone could lose and live. But it's more than that. 3 nights ago, Antoine and I carried his body down the stairs and dug a shallow trench and buried him in the courtyard garden.
Mimi, fourth floor. It has all gone so quiet now, after the scream up above. What is going on? What has she found? This is the part I remember. After this, there is nothing until the blood. It was late and I was tired from all the thoughts whirring around my brain, but couldn't sleep. I couldn't stop thinking about what I had read, what I saw, Ben, and my mother. I destroyed my paintings of him, but it didn't feel like enough. I could see him over there in his apartment, working away at his computer. But it was all different now. I knew what he was writing about, and the thought of it made me feel sick all over again. I could never unknow it, even if I tried not to believe it. But I think I do. I think I do believe it. The hushed tones everyone uses when they talk about Papa's business. Things I've heard Antoine say. It was all beginning to make a horrible kind of sense. Ben came to the window and looked out. I ducked out of sight so he wouldn't spot me. Then I went back to watching. He moved back to his desk, looking at his phone, holding it to his ear. But then he looked up, turned his head. He began to stand. The door was opening. Someone was stepping into the room. Oh, merde. Putain de merde. What was he doing there? It was Papa. He wasn't meant to be home. When did he get back, and what was he doing in Ben's apartment? Papa had something in his hands. I recognized it. It was the magnum of wine he had given Ben as a present only a few weeks earlier. He was going to... I couldn't bear to keep looking, but at the same time I couldn't look away. I watched as Ben crumpled to his knees, as Papa raised the bottle again and again. I watched as Ben staggered backwards, as he collapsed onto the floor, as blood began to soak into the front of his pale t-shirt, turning the whole thing red. And I knew it was all my fault. Ben crawled towards the window. I watched as he raised his hand, hit his palm against the glass. And then he mouthed a word. Help. I saw my father raise the bottle again, and I knew what was going to happen. He was going to kill him. I had to do something. I loved him. Ben had betrayed me. He had destroyed my whole world. But I loved him. I reached for the nearest thing at hand, and then... I ran down the stairs so quickly it felt as though my feet weren't even touching the ground. The door to Ben's apartment was open and Papa was standing over him, and I just had to make him stop. I had to make him stop, and at the same time, maybe there was a little voice inside me saying, he's not really your Papa, this man. And he's not a good man. He's done some terrible things. And now he's about to become a killer, too. Ben was on the ground and his eyes were closed. And then I was behind Papa. He hadn't seen me, hadn't heard me creep into the room. And I had my canvas cutting knife in my hand, and it's small, but the blade is sharp. So very sharp. And I raised it above my head. And then nothing. And then the blood. Later, I thought I heard the sound of voices in the courtyard. I heard the scrape of shovels. It didn't make any sense. Maman likes to garden, but it was dark, nighttime. Why was she doing it now? It couldn't be real, it had to be a dream. Or some kind of nightmare.
Nick, second floor. I remember leaving Papa's study after I told him what Ben had been up to, what he was writing about. I had called him home, told him there was something he needed to hear. As I descended the staircase, I thought about the look on his face, the barely controlled rage. A charge of fear that returned me to childhood. When he wore that expression, it was time to make yourself scarce. But at the same time, I felt a frisson of perverse pleasure, too, at bursting the Benjamin Daniels bubble, at showing Papa that his famous judgment wasn't always as sound as he thought, tarnishing the golden boy he had briefly seemed to hold closer than his own sons. I had betrayed Ben, yes, but in a much smaller way than he had betrayed me and my family's hospitality. He had it coming. Any feeling of triumph soured quickly. Suddenly, I wanted to be numb. I went and took 4 of the little blue pills and lay in my apartment in an oxycodone haze. Maybe I was aware of some kind of commotion upstairs. I don't know. It was like it was happening in another universe. But after a while, as the pills began to wear off, I thought perhaps I should go and see what was going on. I met Antoine on the stairs. Could smell the booze on him. He must have been passed out in yet another drunken stupor. "What the fuck's happening?" he asked. His tone was gruff, but there was something fearful in his expression. "I have no idea," I said. This wasn't quite true. Already an unnameable suspicion was forming in my mind. We climbed to the 3rd floor together. The blood. That was the first thing I saw. So much of it. Sophie in the middle of it all. "There's been a terrible accident." That was what she told us. I knew in an instant that this was my fault. I had set all of this in motion. I knew what kind of man my father was. I should have known what he might be driven to do. But I'd been so blinded by my own anger, my sense of betrayal. I told myself I was protecting my family, but I also wanted to lash out, to hurt Ben somehow. But this, the blood, that terrible inert form wrapped in the curtain shroud, I could not look at it. In the bathroom, I vomited as though I could expel the horror like something I had eaten. But of course it did not leave me. It was part of me now. Somehow, I pulled myself together. Ben was beyond help. I knew I had to do this, now, for the survival of the family. The terrible weight of the body in my arms. But none of it felt real. Part of me thought that if I looked at Ben's face, it would make it real. Perhaps that was important, for some sort of closure. But in the end, I couldn't bring myself to do it. To undo all that tight binding, to confront what lay beneath. "So you see, this is what happened. 3 nights ago, Ben died. And we buried him. Didn't we?"
Sophie, penthouse. From the moment I saw her, covered in blood, my husband's blood, I acted so quickly, almost without thought. Everything I did was to protect my daughter. It is possible that I was in shock too, but my mind seemed very clear. I have always been single-minded, focused, able to make the best out of a bad situation. It's how I ended up with this life after all. I knew that if I were to have the cooperation of his sons, their help in this, Jacques would have to be alive. I knew that it had to be Benjamin who had died. Before I wrapped the body, I had held Jacques' phone up to his face, unlocked it, changed the passcode. I have kept it on me ever since, messaging Antoine and Nicolas as their papa. The longer I could keep Jacques alive, the more I could get out of his sons. After I had done what I could for Benjamin, stemming the blood with a towel, cleaning the wounds, the concierge and I brought him up here to the Chambre du Bon. He was too concussed to struggle, too badly injured to try and free himself. Here, I've been keeping him alive, just. I've been giving him water, scraps of food. The other day, a quiche from the boulangerie. All until I could decide what to do with him. He was so badly wounded that it might have been easier to let nature take its course. But we had been lovers. There was still that reminder of what we had briefly been to each other. I am many things. A whore, a mother, a liar, but I am not a killer. Unlike my beloved daughter. Jacques has gone away for a while, I told my stepsons when they arrived. It is best that no one knows he was here in Paris tonight. So as far as you know, should anyone ask, he has been away the entire time on one of his trips, yes? They nodded at me. They have never liked me, never approved of me. But in their father's absence, they were hanging on my every word, wanting to be told what to do, how to act. They have never really grown up, either of them. Jacques never allowed them to. I think of the gratitude that I'd felt to Jacques in the beginning, for rescuing me from my previous life. I didn't realize at the time how cheaply I'd been bought. I didn't free myself when I married my husband as I'd thought. I didn't elevate myself. I did the exact opposite. I married my pimp. I chained myself to him for life. Perhaps my daughter did the very thing I hadn't had the courage to do.
Jess. I grip the knife, ready to defend Ben and myself, should either of them come closer. Strangely, they don't seem so threatening right now. The air feels less charged with tension. Nick is looking from Sophie to Ben and back, his eyes wild. Something else is going on here. Something I can't understand. And yet, still I grip the knife. I can't let my guard down. My husband is dead, Sophie Minier says. That is what happened. At these words, I watch Nick stagger backwards. He didn't know.
Qui?
He says, hoarsely.
Qui?
I think he must be asking who. My daughter, Sophie Meunier says. She was trying to protect Ben. I have been keeping your brother here. She gestures in our direction. I have kept him alive. She says it like she thinks she deserves some sort of credit. I can't find the words to answer. I look from one to the other, trying to work out how to play this. Nick is a shrunken figure, crouched down, head in his hands. Sophie Meunier is the threat here, I'm sure. I'm the one with the knife, but I wouldn't put anything past her. She steps towards me. I raise the knife, but she barely seems fazed. You are going to let us go, I say, trying to sound a lot more assertive than I feel. I might have a knife, but she has us trapped here. The outside gate is locked. I'm quickly realizing there's no way we're getting out of this place unless she agrees to it. I doubt Ben can stand without a lot of help, and there's the whole building between us and the outside world. She's probably thinking the same thing. She shakes her head.
I cannot do that.
Yes, you have to. I need to take him to hospital. No. I won't tell them, I say quickly. Look, I won't say how he got the injuries. I'll tell them he fell off his moped or something. I'll say he must have come back to his apartment, that I found him.
They won't believe you, she says.
I'll find a way to convince them. I won't tell. I can hear desperation in my voice now. I'm begging. Please. You can take my word for it.
And how can I be sure of that?
What other choice do you have? I ask. What else can you do?
I take a risk here.
Because you can't keep us here forever. People know I'm here. They'll come looking.
Not exactly true. There's Theo, but he's presumably banged up in a cell right now, and I never told him the address. It would take him some time to find out. But she doesn't need to know this. I just need to sell it.
And I know you aren't a killer, Sophie. As you say, you kept him alive. You wouldn't have done that if you were.
She watches me levelly. I have no idea if any of this is working. I sense I need something more. I think of how she said, "My daughter," the intensity of the feeling in it. I need to appeal to that part of her. "Mimi is safe," I say. "I promise you that much. If what you're saying is true, she saved Ben's life. That means a lot. That means everything. I will never tell anyone what she did. I swear to you, that secret is safe with me."
Sophie, penthouse. Can I trust her? Do I have any other choice? I will never tell anyone what she did. Somehow she has managed to guess my greatest fear. She is right. If I wanted to kill them, I would have done so already. I know that I cannot trap the two of them here indefinitely, nor do I want to. But I don't think my stepsons will cooperate with me now. Nicola appears to be falling apart at the realization of his father's death. Antoine has helped so far only because he thought he was doing his father's bidding. I dread to think what his reaction will be when he learns the truth. I will have to work out what to do with him. But that's not my main problem now. "You will not tell the police," I say. "It isn't a question." She shakes her head. "The police and I don't get along." She points to Nicholas. "He'll back me up on that." But Nicholas barely seems to hear her. So she keeps talking, her voice low and urgent. "Look, I'll tell you something if it helps. My dad was a copper, actually. A real fucking hero to everyone else. Except he made my mum's life hell. But no one would believe me when I told them about it. How he treated her. How he hit her. Because he was a good guy. Because he put bad guys in jail. And then..." She clears her throat. "And then one day, it got too much for my mum. She decided it would just be easier to stop trying. So, no, I don't trust the police. Not here, not anywhere. Even before I met your guy, Blanchon. You have my word that I'm not going to go and tell them about this." So she knows about Blanchon. I had wondered about calling him for help here. But he's always been Jacques's man. I do not know if his loyalties would extend to me. I cannot risk him learning the truth. I size the girl up. I realize that almost in spite of myself, I believe her. Partly because of what she's just told me about her father. Partly because I can see it in her face, the truth of it. And finally, because I'm not sure I have any other choice but to trust her. I have to protect my daughter at all costs. That is all that matters now.
Nick, second floor. I am numb. I know that feeling will return at some point, and that no doubt when it does, the pain will be terrible. But for now, there is only this numbness. There is a kind of relief in it. Perhaps I do not yet know what to feel. My father is dead. I've spent a childhood terrorized by him, my whole adult life trying to escape him. And yet, God help me, I loved him too. I am acting on pure instinct, like an automaton, as I help to lift Ben to carry him down the stairs. And though I am numb, I am still aware of the strange and terrible echo of 3 nights ago, when I carried another body, so stiff and still, out into the courtyard garden. For a moment, our eyes meet. He seems barely conscious, so perhaps I am imagining it. But I think I see something in his expression. An apology? A farewell? But just as quickly it is gone. And his eyes are closing again. And I know I wouldn't trust it anyway. Because I never knew the real Benjamin Daniels at all.
A week later. Jess. We sit in silence across the formica table, my brother and I. Ben knocks back the espresso in its little paper cup. I tear one end from my croissant and chew. This may be a hospital cafe, but it's France, so the pastries are still pretty good. Finally, Ben speaks.
I couldn't help myself, you know?
That family. Everything we never had. I wanted to be part of it.
I wanted them to love me.
And at the same time, I wanted to destroy them. Partly for living off women who might have been mum at one stage in her life. But also, I suppose, just because I could. He's looking bloody awful. Half his face covered in dark green bruising. The skin above his eyebrow stapled together. His arm in a cast. When we sat down, the woman next to us gave a little start of shock and glanced quickly away. But knowing Ben, he'll have an attractive scar to show for it soon enough. One he'll work into his charm offensive. I brought him to the hospital in a taxi, with cash from his wallet, naturally. Explained that he'd had a fall on his moped near his apartment. Got a pretty bad head injury. Said he'd made it back to his place and collapsed there, totally out of it, until I turned up and saved the day. It raised a few eyebrows. Crazy English tourists. But they've treated him.
Thanks, he says suddenly. I can't believe what you went through. I knew I should have told you not to come and stay.
Well, thank God you didn't, right? Because I wouldn't have been able to save your life. He swallows. I can tell he doesn't like hearing it. It's uncomfortable, acknowledging that you need people. I know this.
I'm sorry, Jess.
Well, don't expect me to rescue you next time.
Not just for that. For not being there when you needed me. For not being there the one time it really mattered. You shouldn't have had to find her alone.
A long silence. Then he says,
you know, in a way, I've always been jealous of you.
For what?
You got to see her one last time. I never got to say goodbye.
I can't think of anything to say to this. I couldn't have imagined anything worse than finding her. But maybe part of me understands. Ben glances up. I follow his gaze and see Theo in a dark coat and scarf, hand raised, on the other side of the windows. I might have lost my phone, but luckily I still had his business card in my stuff. With his split lip, he now looks like a pirate who's been in some sort of duel. He looks good, too. I turn back to Ben. Hey, I say. Your article. You still have it, right? He raises his eyebrows.
Yes. Christ knows what they did to my laptop, but I'd already backed it up to my cloud. Any writer worth their salt knows that.
It needs to come out, I say.
I know. I was thinking the same thing, but...
I hold up a finger. We have to do it right. If it publishes, the police will have to look into the club. And those girls who work there. Most of them will get deported, right? Ben nods. So, it'll be even worse for them than it is now, I say. I think of Irina. I can't go back. It wasn't a good situation. I think of how she spoke about wanting a new life. I promised that if I found Ben, I would find a way to help her. I'm definitely not going to be responsible for her being sent home. If we get this wrong, only the vulnerable will get screwed. I know this. I look at Ben, and then at Theo as he crosses the room to join us.
I have an idea.
Sophie, penthouse. The cream-colored envelope trembles in my hand. Hand-delivered to the apartment building's postbox this morning. I tear it open, slide out a folded letter. I've never seen this handwriting before. A rather untidy scrawl. Madame Meunier. There was something we didn't get a chance to discuss. I think we both had other things on our minds. Anyway, I made you a promise. I haven't talked to the police and I won't. But Ben's article about Le Petit Mort will publish in 2 weeks' time, whether you do anything or not. I catch my breath. But if you help, it'll have a different emphasis. Either you can be part of the story, take its starring role, or he'll make sure you aren't named, that you're left out of it as far as possible. And your daughter won't be mentioned at all. I grip the letter tighter. Mimi. I've sent her away to the south of France to paint, to recuperate. This went against every maternal instinct. I didn't want to be separated from her, knowing how vulnerable she was, how angry. But I knew she couldn't stay here with the shadow of death hanging over this place. But before she left, I explained it all to her in my own words. How much she was wanted when she came into my life. How much she is loved. How I have never thought of her as anything other than my very own. My miracle. My wondrous girl. I've also tried to make her see that in the circumstances, she did the only thing she could that night. That she saved a life as well as taking one. That she too acted out of love. I did not tell her I might have done the same. That for a brief time, he was almost everything to me too. But I suspect she knows somehow about the affair, if that is what one can call those snatched few weeks of selfish, reckless, glorious insanity. I know that things may never again be the same between my daughter and I. But I can hope. And love her. It is all I can do. I too would leave this place and join her, given the choice. But my late husband is buried in the garden. I have to stay. It is something I have made my peace with. This may be a gilded cage, but it is the life I have chosen. I keep reading. Nick won't be mentioned either. Maybe he's not a bad guy, underneath it all. I think he just made some questionable choices. PTO. Nicholas has also left, along with the few possessions he kept here. I don't think he'll be back. I think it will be good for him to leave this place, to stand on his own 2 feet. My other stepson remains here, and while he isn't the most congenial of neighbors, it is better having him where I can keep an eye on him. And he is a less threatening presence now. I don't think I'll be receiving any more of his little notes. He seems diminished by everything, by the grief he feels for a father who was rarely anything other than cruel to him. In spite of myself, I feel for him. I turn the letter over, read on. Here's what I'm asking you to do. Those girls, the ones at the club, the ones who are your daughter's age, who are being screwed by rich, important guys so that all of you can live in that place, you're going to do right by them. You're going to give every one of them a nice big chunk of cash. I shake my head. There's no way. I suppose you'll say the building, all that, is in your husband's name. But what about those pictures on the walls? What about those diamonds in your ears, that cellar of wine downstairs? I'm not exactly an expert, but even by my modest estimate, you're sitting on quite a fortune. I'm telling you now that you should sell it to someone who doesn't want a paper trail, someone who pays cash. I'll give you a couple of weeks. It'll give the girls a chance to sort themselves out, too. But then Ben's story has to go to print. He's got an editor who's expecting it, after all, and that place needs to disappear. Le Petit Mort needs to die its own little death. The police will have to investigate then. Maybe not as hard as they might do, considering they're probably tied up in it. I'm asking you to do all of this as a mother, as a woman. Besides, something tells me you wouldn't mind being completely free of that place yourself. Am I right? I fold the letter again, slide it back into the envelope. And then I nod. I glance up, feeling watched. My gaze goes straight to the cabin in the corner of the courtyard. But there's no one inside. I looked for her that night. I searched the building from top to bottom, thinking that she couldn't possibly have gone far with her injuries. I even looked in her cabin, but there was no sign. along with the photographs on the wall, several of the smallest and yet most valuable items from the apartment, that little Matisse, for example, and also my silver whippet baignoire. The concierge was gone.
An article in the Paris Gazette. It would appear that the owner of La Petite Mort, Jacques Meunier, has vanished in the wake of the sensational allegations about the exclusive nightclub. The police are now attempting to conduct a full-scale investigation, though this is reportedly hampered by the fact that there are no witnesses available for questioning. Every dancer formerly employed by the club has apparently disappeared. This may come as something of a relief for the former patrons of the club's alleged illegal activities. However, an anonymized website has recently published what it claims is a list of accounts from La Petite Mort's records, listing dozens of names from the great and good of the French establishment. In addition, a high-ranking police official, Commissaire Blanchot, has tendered his resignation following the circulation of explicit images purporting to show him, in flagrante, with several women in one of the club's basement rooms. As has previously been reported, Meunier's son, Antoine Meunier, allegedly his father's right-hand man, shot himself with an antique firearm at the family property in order to avoid being taken into custody.
Epilogue. Jess. I trundle my suitcase across the concourse at Gare de l'Est, the broken wheel catching every few steps. I really do need to get it fixed. I look up at the screen to find my train. There it is. The night service to Milan, where I'll change before going on to Rome. In the early hours of the morning, we'll travel along the shore of Lake Geneva, and apparently when it's clear, you can see the Alps. Sounds pretty good to me. I thought it was time for my own European tour of sorts. Ben's staying here to make a name for himself as an investigative journalist. So, for perhaps the first time ever, I'm the one leaving him. Not running from anything or anyone. Just travelling, in search of the next adventure. I've even got a place waiting for me. A studio, which is actually a fancy word for a tiny room where you can reach everything from the bed. Funnily enough, it's a conversion of an old maid's quarters at the top of an apartment block. And apparently, it has a view of St. Peter's, if you squint. It probably won't be much bigger than the concierge's cabin. But then, I don't have that much to put in it. The contents of one broken suitcase. Anyway, it's all mine. No, not mine. I didn't buy it. Are you crazy? Even if I did somehow have the cash, I wouldn't want my name on the deeds for anything. Wouldn't want to be tied down. But I did put down the deposit on it and paid the first month in advance. I took a cut of the money the girls at the club were getting. A kind of finder's fee, if you like. I'm not a saint, after all. As for the girls, the women, I should say. Of course, I couldn't hold each of their hands and make sure it was all going to be okay. But it's nice to know that they've been given the same thing I have. That it'll buy them time. A little breathing room. Maybe even the opportunity to do something else. 20 minutes before my train leaves. I look around for somewhere to grab a snack. And as I do, I glimpse a figure moving through the crowd. Small, with a familiar, crouching, shuffling gait. A silk headscarf. A silver whippet on a lead. Joining the queue of people waiting to board a train. I look up at the screen above the platform. To Nice, in the south of France. And then I glance away. And don't look again until the train is pulling out of the platform. Because we're all entitled to that, aren't we? The chance of a new life. Acknowledgements.
I loved writing this book. At the same time, it was the hardest of my books to write, partly because it was the most complicated structure and premise I've attempted yet, and partly because it was written first while I was very pregnant and then with a new baby in tow, and during a pandemic. Though, on that score, I know how lucky I am to have a job where I can easily work from home, unlike so many, especially those incredibly brave key workers. Anyway, I'm so proud of this book, and of releasing it into the world. It's not very British to say it, but I am. At the same time, it feels so, so important to stress that none of it would have been possible without the hard work of some very kind, dedicated, and talented people. There really should be multiple names on that front cover. This book has been a huge team effort. Thank you to the phenomenal Kath Summerhayes for your endless wit and wisdom and sage counsel, and for being such fun to work with and to go for lunch with and for cocktails with, and for always being there on the end of the phone. I am so lucky to have you and so grateful for everything you do. Thank you to the incredible Alexandra Machinist for your unfailingly excellent advice and unbelievable negotiating skills. And though for the time being our planned Parisian adventures have fallen foul of the winter vomiting virus, I know we'll be having a glass of champagne on the terrace soon. I can't wait to toast your brilliance. Thank you to Kim Young for being the most patient and supportive of editors, for championing this book from its first inception and, frankly, fairly ropey, first draft. You always know how to coax my best work from me. You inspire me with your belief in me and my writing. Thank you for holding my hand throughout this whole process and for always being ready to jump on the phone to discuss a mad new plot idea. Thank you to Kate Ninsel for your masterly editorial counsel, for your razor-sharp eye and overall publishing wizardry. I still can't quite believe what you have achieved with the guest list in the US, bringing my dark little British book to well over 1 million readers. I am so lucky to have you as my champion. Thank you to the utterly brilliant Charlotte Brabin. You are such a talented, dedicated editor. I am so grateful for all your hard work and advice, tact and creativity, and for always being ready and willing for a brainstorm. However small or silly the query, whatever time of day or night. Thank you to Luke Speed for all your kindness and wisdom, and for your endless patience in explaining the magical and mystifying world of film to me. And thank you at the same time for being such fun to work with. You and Kath are the dream team. May there be many more lunches and cinema dates. Thank you to Katie McGowan, Callum Mollison, and Grace Robinson for your incredible work in finding my books so many publishers around the world. It's such a thrill to think of them being translated into other languages and finding so many new readers globally. I'm in awe of what you do. Thank you to the fabulous Harper Fiction family, to Kate Elton, Charlie Redmayne, Isabel Coburn, Abby Salter, Hannah O'Brien, Sarah Shea, Janelle Brew, Amy Winchester, Claire Ward, Roger Cazalet, Izzy Coburn, Alice Gomer, Sarah Monroe, Charlotte Brown, Grace Dent, and Ben Hurd. I am so lucky to be published by you all. I'm so hoping we all get to raise a glass together soon. Thank you to the brilliant team at William Morrow, to Brian Murray, Liette Stilik,
Molly Gendel, Brittany Hills, Caitlin Harry, Sam Glatt, Jennifer Hart, Stephanie Vallejo, Pam Barricklow, Grace Han, and Jean Rayner. Thank you so much for your tireless work and dedication and for championing my books stateside. I can't wait to visit you all in New York and celebrate together. Thank you to the wonderful wider Curtis Brown A-team, to Johnny Geller, Jess Molloy, and Anna Weglin. Thank you to my darling friend, Anna Barrett, for doing such a fantastic early read-through and edit of The Paris Apartment when I was too scared to show it to anyone else, for hugely boosting my confidence in the book with your encouragement and suggestions. I highly recommend Anna if you're looking for an independent edit of your novel. She's at www.the-writers-space.com. Last, but very much not least, thank you to my family. Thank you to the Folly, Collie, and Allen clans for all your support. Thank you to my wonderful siblings, Kate and Robbie. Again, thank God, nothing like the siblings in this book. I'm so proud of you both, and so lucky to have you. Thank you to my parents, for your pride in me, and for the endless, unflagging support. Thank you for forgiving me for turning up to stay, only to dump the wee man on you with no warning and disappear behind my laptop. For being such kind and loving grandparents, feeding and playing and looking after the little guy so lovingly and uncomplainingly while I've been mired in copy edits and proofreads. Thank you for encouraging me in my storytelling since I was a little girl, telling Farmer P tales in the back seat. Thank you to Al for quite literally making all of this possible, for holding the baby, for putting stuff on hold to help me, for talking me through plot crises at 3 a.m. and on walks and drives and over dinners we've gone out for and holidays we've taken to get away from the book, for your wisdom, for your support, your belief, your encouragement, for reading through almost as many drafts of this book as I have myself, biro in hand, even when knackered from a day's work or baby wrangling, or both. You say 20%. I say, I owe you everything.
The Paris Apartment by Lucy Foley. Read by Chope Derisu, Sophia Zervudaci, Charlie Anson, Claire Corbett, Daphne Kumar, and Julia Winwood. Produced by ID Audio. With post-production by ID Audio. A HarperCollins audiobook. Text copyright Lost and Found Limited, 2022. Production copyright 2022 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Lucy Foley asserts the moral right to be identified as the author of this work. Thank you for listening.